College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandy.
I don't think I can remember the college football quarterback of a losing team throwing 9 touchdowns in a loss. A loss, a 32-point home lead turns into a collapse at the hands of Chip Kelly. I got to say one thing, inject Pac-12 After Dark into my veins every single weekend. And as he does every Monday, Kirk Herbstreit joining us to discuss what he saw from the weekend. Herbie, this felt like a weekend where we could start to sort some things out, and then UCLA scores 50 points in the second half to shock undefeated Washington State. What an incredible nightcap to all that we saw on Saturday.
Unreal. Yeah, you're like me. You watch games from noon Eastern all the way through the day and into the evening. You think you're done around midnight, and you know, for the Pac-12 games like that, you're at halftime, you know, and we've been trained that UCLA is in a rebuilding phase with Chip Kelly, and you know, what are they averaging, about 14 points a game, and they're down big, and there's Mike Leach in Washington State with his newest found toy and Gordon the quarterback, and away we go. Let's move on to the week 5, and all of a sudden you start to hear a few scores and you're like, what's going on? Washington State took the lead back. Okay, everything's fine. No, what? They did it again. They scored it. It was unreal if you were still awake to follow that game. And it was almost like, to me, Kevin, UCLA had 2 years of frustrations, specifically Chip Kelly,
mm-hmm.
2 years of frustrations just imploded in 30 minutes of football, and they just let it all out, you know, and obviously that's what it took to be able to win 67-63.
Yeah, and then you start to see some of the talent that we've been talking about at UCLA, and Dorian Thompson-Robinson in this offense, and Demetric Felton doing whatever he wanted to do in the second half. And then I come back to Mike Leach here, where you're 3-0 and you found the next really, really exciting quarterback, and he throws 9 touchdowns, and I get it. It's all working. Everything's working, but run the football a little bit. I know it goes against things, but you have this lead. Run a little bit, but we have two guys who are offensive geniuses that expand the passing game and the passing attack, and that's why we get that type of excitement there, and two teams scoring over 60 points to cap the night there. You know, obviously, leading into the weekend, everybody was talking about Georgia and how we were going to learn a few things. I felt like we learned a lot about Notre Dame. I was impressed with what the Irish did in that great techno environment at night in Athens,
yeah.
And they had a chance late there. What was your biggest takeaway from both sides and what you watched on Saturday night?
Well, I think you're all over it. I think you and I, and probably a lot of people, if you're objective and watch this game, let's face it, if you talk to everybody going into the game, it was, Notre Dame's just a step slow. They're just not quite ready, you know, for a big time game and a big time atmosphere. We saw it against Clemson, you know, last year. We've even heard people say, if you go all the way back to when they played Alabama, you know, when they get into these big games, these big showcase games, they just don't have the athletes to stand up. You know, that might not be everybody. But that's I think a large percentage of people feel that Notre Dame's just not quite up with the big boys. With that in mind, all of us have talked about how there's about 6 teams and everybody else after week 2 or week 3 going into week 4, and Georgia was part of that 6. So you can't look and watch that game and then take away anything other than, hey, Jake Fromm and Georgia, give them all the credit. They found a way to win this game in a very heated battle that was going back and forth. They controlled the game for the most part until maybe the weaning moments of the game, and seemed to have it, you know, under control. But I took away that, you know, Georgia's good. Georgia's got some stuff they need to correct. But Notre Dame, I'm like you. I took away Notre Dame went into that environment after hearing all the cynics and how they can't step up with the big guys, and clearly took this personal. Remember the last time we saw them in a really heated battle on the road,
mm-hmm.
a couple years ago against Miami, and they just laid an egg. It mm-hmm. was an embarrassment for Brian Kelly and for Notre Dame. They were ranked up in a top 5 at the time, and I think that left a lot of scars. Well, they were determined not to experience that again, so I give Ian Book a lot of credit. I give that defense a lot of credit for hanging in there against a lot of speed from Georgia. And I think Notre Dame, you know, we always talk about, they're not in a conference, but we talk about teams that are in a conference being willing to play those high profile games as opposed to cupcakes. And those teams that are in the SEC and the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and the Big 12, when they play a big game like Texas and LSU, if you compete and you don't embarrass yourself, to me, how does that hurt you? The willingness to play a big time opponent and then you competed and really helped your brand. How can you not say that about Notre Dame? Playing in Athens, walking away and out of that game, a lot of people saying, man, if they get that pass interference call, you never know.
Yep.
I mean, the fact that you can just say that, whether it was a pass interference or not, the fact that it came down to being that close, Notre Dame to me helps their cause as we go into week 7, 8, 9, 10. They did not hurt themselves at all by competing. And, you know, they're not into moral victories, but to me, that was a great effort. And to me, I walk away more impressed by Notre Dame than saying, same old Notre Dame. I don't feel that at all.
It'll be really interesting, too, to see how this plays out, because down at the end of the season, when we have a potential conversation, if there is a one-loss team that should be in the argument, and you make a case, hey, hypothetically, Georgia loses to Alabama in the SEC championship game, and it's like, do we make a case here? What happens to LSU down the road? And then you look at Notre Dame, and if they have one loss on that schedule, and it is what they did against Georgia, and then you look at who they play the rest of the way, you have to wonder, will people count out USC being down this year? Will they count out Stanford being down this
Michigan.
Year? Yeah, Michigan being down this year. Now they have a undefeated Virginia coming in, and how do we judge that team in this type of matchup? So I'm curious to see how this plays out. It's September, but how will this play out in conversations in November?
Kevin, just to me, based on what I've watched with this playoff committee, Notre Dame, whether we like to admit it or not, I think that brand still carries itself.
Yes.
I think it helps in these debates with the committee, and it shouldn't, but it does. That's just a reality. With that being said, because of who they play, I think they have to, it's too early to say this, but if you're going into late November, December, they don't have a conference championship game, kind of that closing argument, while others that they're going to be competing against will have that potential closing argument. To me, it has to be one of those things where they're not only winning games, but they're drilling people. Like it's like you watch them and you go, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want to play those guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of that kind of thing, as opposed to, well, let's get all the metrics out. Let's pour it out here. Let's look at USC. Let's look common opponent. It's going to be one of those things that Notre Dame is playing at a level where you don't want to see them play your team. To me, that's where it's going to have to, because Michigan's not Michigan this year. Stanford obviously is not Stanford. USC, you know, if they go to Seattle and win, if you're a Notre Dame fan, you're pulling for USC to go up to Seattle and find a way to win if ends up being your third string quarterback. So, but that's to me where Notre Dame's going to have to take that next step, is lose this game, now go take care of business and look good doing it.
Okay, looking good. There were a couple takeaways on the other side with Georgia. I felt like they went very conservative in the first half, but that Fromm pass to Cager was beautiful.
Yeah.
And those are the moments where you're like, oh, I get it. I get why he beat Justin Fields and Jacob Eason. And this is what he does week in and week out. He understands what Georgia needs in that offense, and he makes the play when they have to.
Yeah, and it just Georgia's offense, still a work in progress. I think let's give again Notre Dame's defense a lot of credit. I mean, if you can hold Swift under 100 yards, that says a lot. I think Georgia would love to have maybe the game back and maybe attack it in a different way. I mean, Fromm misses only 6 passes, but he only throws for 187 yards. Notre Dame keeping everything in front of them, not giving up those potential big plays. But yeah, when it was time to make a play, that's where the accuracy, the experience of Jake Fromm comes up and gives Cager a chance to go up and make a play and use his size and get that pivotal touchdown for him.
We'll be back in a minute with the best thing that Herbie saw this weekend. But first, a word from Allstate. Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today.
Now, what's the best thing you saw over the weekend?
Oh, man. I would lean towards probably what Wisconsin did as far as the way they did it and how dominating, which leads us maybe to a discussion about Michigan here. This was not, you know, pile on Michigan. For me, it was just nobody really knew who Wisconsin was. I mean, they beat up a couple inferior opponents. They had a bye week leading into the Michigan game. This Wisconsin team reminds me, I said before the season, the team that opened up at Lambeau against LSU, and everybody kind of laughed at LSU's about to destroy Wisconsin. No one knew who Jack Sitchie really was, or even TJ Watt for that matter at that point. And that Wisconsin team kind of played with a chip on their shoulder. And I said before the season, this team is going to remind me of that. And so far, they seem to really be playing with a chip on their shoulder with Jim Leonard in the defense. It's incredible how they evaluate high school linebackers, develop college linebackers, and get them on the field. They're on about a 20-year run of producing outstanding linebacker play at that university. And, you know, I think that was on display again at Camp Randall against Michigan. You could say everything you want to say about Jonathan Taylor and how good he is. We've known that for a few years. But I think they're getting just enough from the quarterback play. I think that Cone is a guy that right now the team seems to want to play for and rally around. He was 13 of 16, didn't throw for a lot of yards, but it's just enough to be efficient, keep people off of loading up against Taylor in the running game. And I think they're going to get better and better with the passing game. And if they get better in that area, the potential big plays to go along with Taylor, then they really become dangerous. And they've got some exciting games coming up. So that was that and Auburn going to Kyle Field and playing the way they did with Bo Nix, another team that every week is only going to get better and better with a freshman quarterback. That was an impressive win. I always say if you're in the SEC West and you want to throw your hat in the ring with Alabama and with LSU and the big boys, you've got to go to Kyle Field and win. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to go to Starkville and win. You got to go into some interesting, tough environments and win. And Auburn did that. And I think people feel differently this week about Auburn, maybe compared to how they felt before they went on the road to take on Jimbo Fisher's team.
And it felt like in that game with Elko and that matchup on the defensive coordinator on one side for A&M, it felt like Gus opened up the playbook a little bit more and said, I've got a couple plays here that I've been holding back.
Yeah.
And let's try to see if we can catch these guys being over aggressive. That worked out really well for Auburn. They have a brutal schedule. It's been much discussed about A&M and Auburn and their brutal schedules, this upcoming season. I'm with you on Wisconsin on a couple things, because when you look at what they did, they've given up only 14 points all season. What stood out to me is, they came into that game against Michigan and said, we are not afraid of what you're going to do on defense or offense. We're going to do what we want to do, and we're going to give the ball to Jonathan Taylor in the first quarter, and you will not stop him.
Right.
And maybe that's a conversation to, okay, let's question some things with Michigan and Don Brown and this defense. But to me, it's Jonathan Taylor, the guy that in the year of the quarterback, when you look at Heisman topics and conversations, Jonathan Taylor separates himself on what he can do in this offense. He is so dynamic, and he's not the standard Wisconsin running back that I think everybody's used to seeing.
Well, and when you know it's coming and you still can't stop it, that says a lot about the execution of the offense. I think they're doing a good job of keeping it diversified enough where it's, you know, Paul Christ, probably one of the underappreciated play callers of this generation, because we live in this spread attack. We live in this four receivers, get everybody in space kind of world that we all watch almost every Saturday. And Wisconsin can go there, but at the end of the day, they've got to recruit offensive linemen. They've got to recruit running backs. That's just who they're, that's their brand. That's who they are. And it's kind of a dinosaur, in the modern game. And I think because of that, Paul Christ sometimes, doesn't quite get the appreciation, but he's very innovative, very creative in how he tries to attack teams. He studies, you know, in Don Brown's case, they're going to play a ton of man. We're going to find ways to get guys out of position to try to free up Jonathan Taylor. If we can hit that first level and get him some space, all of a sudden we've moved that safety with pre-snap motion or moving a tight end, just little nuances that, again, I think sometimes overlook. And now all of a sudden he's got a lot of room. There were a couple runs that he had where he made the first guy miss, and all of a sudden it's like, where is everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Well, give Paul Christ credit for the formation and the pre-snap movement. That has a lot to do with why Taylor has that room. One other one that I'll add on as far as a positive, and there are a lot of them, but it went back to Friday night, and that was USC. Clay Helton has been, you know, quote unquote fired by the media and by fans for 2 or 3 years, and somehow he keeps showing up for some reason. Nobody emailed him and let him know he's been fired, so he just keeps showing up on the sidelines, and so he's still coaching, still wears a hat, has a whistle, and they give him shoes and a Nike shirt, and he runs out there, and he's still the coach, believe it or not. And here he is, 3-1. And we talked before the season started, how is he going to survive these first six games? They have no chance to win at all. Maybe three max, and mm-hmm. max they'll win is three in these first six. Look where they have to go, and look who they're playing, and yet here they are, 3-1. And not only that, but he loses his quarterback, JT Daniels, who won the quarterback competition, which we all kind of rolled our eyes. Quarterback competition? JT Daniels is back. There's no way there's a quarterback competition. Well, when he goes out and Keaton Slovis comes in mm-hmm. and performs very, very well, we thought, well, maybe there was a battle. And this Slovis kid's pretty good for a freshman. And then you and I talked about that last week, and he's doing some good things. And then he gets dinged early against a really good Utah defense that some have said is Kyle Whittingham's best, which is a bold statement that he's ever had at Salt Lake. And they're going to turn to a kid named Matt Fink, who's a redshirt junior, who when he lost the battle in the spring, took a month to contemplate. He entered the transfer portal. He's like, man, I've had enough. I mean, he'd been here for 3.5 years. You know what? Forget this place. They don't appreciate my skills. I'm out of here. So he enters the portal, kind of thinks about it with his family, going to go to Illinois. He's out of here. He's going to go play for the Fighting Illini. And for whatever reason, he and his family decide, you know what? Let's stay. Let's get our degree from SC. Let's ride this out. And loses, obviously, we just talked about the battle in August to the younger players. He's already been passed by a true freshman last year in Daniels and another true freshman this year. He loses out the backup job. I mean, you know how easy it would be to go in the tank and kind of give the, you know what you can do with this quarterback job attitude to Clay Helton and to the SC staff. Instead, shows maturity, hangs in there, clearly did what he needed to do in meetings and preparation, because you don't just walk into a game and do what he did and not do what you need to do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday leading up to the game. And so he gets thrown into action. First couple drives, he leads them against this mighty Utah defense, leads them to touchdowns, and it helps lead them pull off a big upset at home, 30-23 over Utah. And now, as I said, SC sitting here 3-1. Back-to-back weeks coming up at Seattle against a Washington team that looks like has righted itself with Jacob Eason. We'll talk about them in a sec. And then they go to South Bend to take on Notre Dame. So they might lose these next two. They might win them. I don't know. But for now, Clay Helton's still a coach. They're 3-1, faced a ton of adversity. And that, to me, is a pretty good, as you're saying, throwing bouquets out over the weekend. Give SC, you know, a salute because they stepped up and beat a very good team.
I'm with you. I completely agree. And I'm a guy that's a huge proponent of the transfer portal, because I think players should be given the option. If coaches can leave, then players can have that option to leave. But then you go back to Fink sticking it out, and then you got to start wondering about Sears. You know, the idea that he had the chance and then he left. And when you look at the depth here at this quarterback position, and Sears, if he would have stuck around, as he's still in the transfer portal, he would have been given maybe potentially the opportunity as this quarterback battle continues. And we have no idea about Slovis's status heading into the weekend as they get ready for Washington. And the Washington conversation is interesting because that one loss is against the Cal team that's 4-0 now, right? And then that environment where they had to wait 2 hours because of the weather delay and dealing with all that. And it's such an early part of the season. We had no idea what to expect with Cal and that offense, and their defense has been fantastic. They steal a win. You can make a case if you ask Ole Miss fans. They steal a win on the road, but they find a way to win going into the SEC this past weekend, as they are now the only undefeated team in the Pac-12 as they get ready for Arizona State.
We talked about Cal last week on College Game Day, and we kind of said, well, they're going into the SEC. It's hot. It's humid. It's Ole Miss, and they're winning with defense and not getting a lot from their offense. And Chase Garbers goes out and against an SEC defense and throws for 357, has four touchdowns. And, you know, people are going to remember the controversial call at the end. What I remember is so much for Cal just winning with their defense. They showed that they have an offense, and they showed that they could throw the football around, with this kid. And, you know, you may say, well, Ole Miss isn't that good. It's not a big deal. I argue that it's still going on the road, and you're not playing Cal Poly. You know, mm-hmm. You're going on the road, and you're playing Ole Miss with SEC athletes, and you're playing at 11 a.m. local, 9 a.m. for your players.
Yep.
And so it'd be very easy, especially you're ranked for the first time in a while, and all of a sudden people are starting to pay attention. It'd be very easy to kind of have one of those weeks. It just, for whatever reason, it's not clicking. You're on the road. Players are starting to read their press clippings a little bit, hearing about all the pats on the back and how great they are. And I thought Justin Wilcox had his team ready to go. Like I said, we've known about him and the defense, and they do just enough on offense, and the quarterback Garbers throws it around, and all of a sudden they're starting to climb the ladder, as you said, in the AP poll. It's kind of fun to see that.
Yeah, Garbers, again, career day. What a big victory as they were trying to sort things out at the end, and how that was – I don't know how you not review that play, but that is for another day and another conversation. We'll be back in a minute as Herbie tells us his biggest disappointment from the weekend. But first, a word from Carhartt. You know who works hard? Rookies! Sure, they make mistakes, but no one's got more to prove. Knowing each day's another opportunity to outwork them all and earn the respect they deserve. Point is, no one outworks a rookie. That's why after 130 years, Carhartt is still approaching each day with the passion and work ethic of a company that's 130 years young. Same hunger, same determination, same giant chip on the shoulder. And in the same way a rookie needs to work hard to earn the respect of their peers, everything Carhartt makes has to keep earning the respect of the hardworking people who wear it. That's why Carhartt still works like a rookie. And why Carhartt will keep outworking them all for the next 130 years, too. Visit Carhartt.com/CFB to learn more and shop this season's hardest working gear. What is your biggest disappointment over the weekend?
Michigan is almost in their own category right now with what is happening there. What is getting most of the attention is the Michigan offense, because you know, we've talked about that for weeks, if not months, about what's going to happen with Josh Gattis, and he's got all this talent to work with, and boy, it's going to be fun to watch. And what happens if there's some trouble? What would Jim Harbaugh do? We all talked about those things in August, and the troubles continue on that side of the ball. But what in the world has happened to Don Brown in the Michigan defense? I can't believe, you know, you go back to the Ohio State game, and the bowl game, and the way they've looked here early, and I can't believe it. I really can't, because I'm as big a fan of that style of defense and that aggressive nature, and we're gonna shoot gaps, and we're gonna penetrate, and we're gonna leave our corners on islands. We don't care, and we're gonna ear hole your quarterback before you can beat us and man. And they've adjusted some. They're not playing maybe quite as much man, but they don't look prepared, which is mind-boggling. They're out of position. They look like they're thinking too much at times instead of just playing. And you know, the season's not over. They could get this thing going, and I think all of us kind of expect them to do that. But I don't know if I've ever seen a Michigan team. You know, there was some lean years with Rich Rod, and even Brady Hoke. But I'm talking about a Michigan team that you had high expectations for. You know, in Chicago at the Big Ten media luncheon, it wasn't Ohio State, it wasn't Wisconsin, it wasn't whoever. It was Michigan selected, a majority of the media selected Michigan to win not only the East, but the Big Ten championship. So the expectations are very high for this team, and they have a lot of experience coming back this year. So that's why I don't know if I've ever seen a team with such high expectations have such a bad Saturday as Michigan on collectively on both sides of the ball. But to add to disappointing, I would say UCF. UCF playing at Pitt. Pitt coming off a tough loss against Penn State in a rivalry game. They get UCF at home. UCF, of course, just came off a big win where they're beating on their chest, and a lot of us kind of were beating on their chest.
We're all loving them, right?
Yeah, man. Hey, they wanted a big-time win, and it's not a great Stanford team, but you know what? They sent a message, and now they're going to go up to Pitt, and they're going to take care of Pitt, and then they'll get into conference play, and, man, this thing's going, and they're going to have a chance at the end maybe. And it creeped in there and got them. And I think it had a lot to do with Narduzzi and Pitt and playing with a chip on their shoulder and wanting to kind of send a message to people that nobody believes in us. We'll show you kind of thing. So they rallied the troops. But if you're just taking away a disappointment from the entire weekend, Michigan to me would be, as I said, their own category. But beyond that, I would say UCF losing in the way they did against Pitt.
Herbie, I brought this one thing up with Harbaugh, is when they hired him, they were looking for an identity. The program was looking for that Michigan identity, and now he's in season 5, 0-7 again as an underdog, and you know all the numbers, what he does against ranked teams and what he does against rivals. I want to ask you, what is Michigan's identity under Jim Harbaugh? Because that's my biggest question. The one thing we could guarantee is no matter what, you're going to play tough, and we're going to see that from the defense. You bring an excellent point with Don Brown. They have not been the same on the defensive side, and I understand they lost a ton of talent in that Florida Bowl game, but still, they have not been the same. What is the identity of this team, especially now that you have Gattis there, and he's changing things up from what we've seen from that offense under Harbaugh when he was at Stanford, when he was with the 49ers? What's the Michigan identity under Harbaugh now?
Great question, and I think Jim Harbaugh is asking himself that, because they don't have an identity right now. They don't. The identity for the last couple years has been, as you said, Don Brown, the defense is going to be tenacious. They're going to bully you. You know you better put your helmet on a little tighter this week. You better maybe go for a little bit bigger set of shoulder pads, because they are going to bring it. Like that side of the ball, you knew what the identity was. Now, you might out-execute them. You might make some plays, but that's always kind of been who they are. The offense has been somewhat stuck in mud, where they didn't really have an identity. Last year, they went to the Shea Patterson, 1 foot in, 1 foot out. We're going to start to spread it. We're going to get away from that power game, the Stanford thought. You know, think about Jim Harbaugh at Stanford. We're going to get away from that, and we're going to dabble in this world of spread because of Shea Patterson, and try to find what we can do, try to get some players out in space. And it was okay, but it wasn't obviously great. It was better than what they're doing this year. And then they said, Jim Harbaugh came out and he said, to heck with it, we're going to get Josh Gattis. He was at Alabama. Before that, he was with Moorhead at Penn State. And we are going to really invest in becoming this spread team and getting people in space and getting our athletes in space. And we got a quarterback who's been doing this since high school. So this is who we're going to be. And think about investing your entire spring, your winter, your spring, your summer camp into that world. And it, after 3 weeks, it's not only is it not working, they had about 300 yards of total offense against Wisconsin, 0-11 on third downs. They had, two interceptions, two fumbles, so the turnovers continue to be a problem. They can't run the football. The line of scrimmage, I said on game day, the most underachieving group so far, you could argue, in the country is the Michigan offensive line, a veteran group that, for whatever reason, I don't know if there's lacking continuity in this new system. I don't know if they're not communicating. I don't know if they're just not good. But whatever it is, they are struggling to be able to run the football. 40 yards rushing against Wisconsin, and that's Michigan. So I don't care what system you run. If you're Michigan, you've got to be able to run the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And you need elite running backs. You need people that strike fear in the opponent. And I don't know if they have that right now. It's just, I don't know if there's a guy on the roster that does that. You know, look at the teams like Alabama, LSU, Ohio State, Georgia, whoever you want to talk of those elite teams who Michigan's trying to be. They have players that when the ball is in their hands, you hold your breath
mm-hmm.
because he might go all the way. Every time he touches it, you're like, oh my gosh, you better tackle him. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Because does Michigan have a guy that you've seen yet that does that when he gets his hands on the ball? I haven't seen it. And I think there's some of the receivers that have that potential, but I don't know if they have that in the backfield. They'll get a guy to get a solid six for you. He'll get four. He'll bounce one and get eight or 10, but nobody. And so my point in saying that is, as a defensive coordinator, I don't fear that until you make me fear it. I don't fear it. So I can risk and put more coverage on those receivers. I can double Tariq Black or Donovan Peoples-Jones or whoever I need to, Nico Collins. Because, man, we got the running game handled. They might hit us for four or six, but there's no fear in that running game.
Nope.
So it makes it really hard when you're not able to win the line of scrimmage and you don't have a back that can hit a crease and go 40 or 80. It makes it really, really hard on an offense when you can't do that. And I think that's what they're trying to figure out right now. These are smart coaches. They know how to coach, despite what maybe the public thinks. And right now, how do you coach when you can't run the football?
It's stunning.
Yeah.
It's stunning. And then they went to Dylan McCaffrey, and you have some hope there, and then he takes a massive hit in that game. Then he's knocked out, and he's done, and they got to come back to Shea Patterson. And you mentioned the playmakers, and I thought one of the guys that was going to be a playmaker is Ronnie Bell. And sometimes he makes a play and sometimes he tries a little too hard. And then you see the ball on the ground and the fundamentals. And I thought that was going to get cleaned up against Army. We haven't seen that cleaned up.
I was just going to say, at least they have Rutgers this week, which it's almost like that's just what the doctor ordered.
Yep.
You know, here's a game to try to, you know what, guys, we're going to eliminate, you go into the coach's office, offensive kind of the big room, right? And you got all these plays. And this week, if I were Jim Harbaugh, I'd take an eraser and I would just be like, okay, I'm going to keep erasing this board. And I would say, okay, what are eight plays that we like this
mm-hmm.
week? Just give me eight.
Yep.
Forget these 38 plays, 50, forget them. We're going to run eight plays this week. We can mix up our formations. We can mix up our personnel groupings. These are the eight plays we're going to execute Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and we're going to give every Rutgers look that is imaginable that they might give us on these eight plays, and we're going to live in these eight plays. That's it. Let's execute these flawlessly because we are better than Rutgers. So let's not overthink this. Let's just hear our plays, and away we go, because we got Iowa coming in next week, and we need to figure this thing out before Iowa's defense comes in here. So that it'd be interesting to watch how this develops. There's still a year that can be exciting and still a year that can win some big games. I mean, they're 2-1. It's not like they're 2-3. They're 2-1. They've got a win this week against Rutgers to get them to 3-1. And then you got Iowa. Then you go to Champaign. And then it's go time in back-to-back weeks at Penn State and Notre Dame at home. So they need to right the ship right now. And of course, that's what Jim Harbaugh is going to try. I'm guessing he takes more of a hands-on approach moving forward with the offense. He's going to have to.
You mentioned the offense. The opposite of that feeling and that vibe is what we're seeing at LSU. Coming off, and we're going to get to the questions from our listeners in a second. We're going to talk about what you most look forward to this coming weekend. But I need to get a quick thought from you about this LSU offense. They have put up 231 points in their first four games, the most for any school in SEC history.
And what Joe Burrow is doing, and they put up 66 points against Vanderbilt. He's the first quarterback in LSU history to toss at least 6 touchdowns in a game. Your quick thoughts on what this offense is doing as they head into the bye before they open things up in October. They got that big showdown against Florida, and of course later on we'll see at the end of the month in November. What are your thoughts here on what you're seeing so far from Burrow in this offense?
You know, we're not supposed to cheer for people, you know, in our sport. I'm very objective in everything I do. I've known Joe Burrow, followed him since he played high school football in Southern Ohio down in Athens, Ohio, and wasn't a ballyhooed recruit. Wasn't a guy that like, oh, we got to have this 5-star. He's a guy that came in and ended up getting his degree, left Ohio State because he didn't win the battle after JT Barrett left and went down to, he looked at Cincinnati, ended up going to LSU, and a lot of people thought, wow, interesting choice. He's going down to LSU. And the first year things were, there were some ups, some downs. It was just okay. And then Joe Brady came in, from the New Orleans Saints to help this offense. And I just happened to be fortunate to call the game a couple weeks ago in Austin and got a chance to see firsthand LSU's offense. And I just fell in love with the offense and the approach that Steve Ensminger, the offensive coordinator, along with Joe Brady and the way they're attacking, fell in love with these wide receivers. Knew about them from last year, but man, they're in this new system. It's like their ears are perked up. They're excited. I mean, they know things are happening and they're going to get chances. The days of just I formation, run, throw on 3rd and 6, got 5.5. Oh, came up a little short. Let's punt the ball. Like those days are over at LSU and they're throwing it and they're attacking and they don't care who you are. They don't care if they're in Austin or in Nashville mm-hmm. or in Tuscaloosa. This is who we are. And we're going to beat you or we're going to lose by being who we are, which I give a lot of credit to Coach O for that approach. So I'm in love with this LSU team. I mean, if we were saying right now, LSU and Alabama, in Tuscaloosa, the only thing I don't know who's going to win the game. All I know is I'd take the over because
yeah.
They are going to score a lot of, it's going to look like a Big 12 game when those two teams play. It's going to be a 52-48 kind of game, which is going to be mind boggling from the days of 9-6 with those teams. It's going to be 52-48 and I can assure you of that. I don't care what Alabama or LSU do defensively between now and then. I want to get to that game because I want to see those two quarterbacks go toe-to-toe, and neither one of them are going to flinch. And I just hope everybody stays healthy by the time we get to November to see Alabama and LSU good against good, healthy against healthy, and may the better team win. That's going to be – they always see game of the century.
Yeah.
That one's going to really be a game of the century because of the two quarterbacks and because of the way the attack offensively. But right now LSU is clearly one of the stories, if not the story, in college football, not just because of the way they're winning. It's the change in philosophy from who they have been for the last 10 or 15 years to who they are this year, not just with Burrow, but with Ensminger and Brady and the way they're attacking with this new passing attack.
It's refreshing to see because we've been talking about it for 15 years. We know they have all the weapons, and we've always said, when are they going to get a quarterback that can move this offense down the field? So circle the date, November 9th, Tuscaloosa, and keep this in mind. Both LSU and Alabama will be coming off byes. So that's a good thing when we talk about health heading into the game. We'll be back in a minute as Herbie tells us what he can't wait to see this upcoming weekend. But first, a word from Goodyear.
Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven.
What are you most looking forward to this coming weekend? And I know I'm going to make sure everybody knows game day is going to Lincoln. Great environment. Nebraska hosting Ohio State. Is there a game that stands out in your mind you can't wait to see?
You know, that one I think typically is interesting. There's some people that say, well, look at Nebraska. They're not quite the same team that people expected. And I'm quick to say, guys, they maybe have not executed to the level that you expect them to execute yet. But a night game, college game day is going to Lincoln, ABC primetime coming from Lincoln. They haven't had things like this in a while. So Scott Frost is bringing a new excitement back, a new energy back to the way it used to be almost every single year in Lincoln. So I think just based on that, there's anticipation and I think there's excitement, for their team to go out. And I expect them to play at a very, very different level. Will it be good enough? We'll see, but I think they'll go out and play, at a different level. Beyond that, I really can't wait to see USC and Washington. SC, we just talked about what they've done. Jacob Eason had a monster game for Washington, really starting to kind of, I think, assert himself based on, okay, we've seen Jake Browning run this offense with Chris Peterson. Now what's it going to look like where Jacob Eason is more of an NFL-style quarterback and he's got some great receivers? And I just think he's, you know, I wanted to see him in that environment in Provo to see, you know, I want to see what this guy can do. He left Georgia. Haven't really seen him play. We saw him against a couple teams that were okay. But what's he going to look like at Provo? And he answered the call clearly and he looked great. And now SC kind of developing confidence of their own on the road again. And that one I think is a big game for both teams. So that one, and then I guess the other one would be Virginia. Not a lot of people nationally know much about UVA other than Bryce Perkins, the quarterback. They're going into South Bend, and it's a top 20 matchup, number 10 and number 18. That's another one I think is interesting, not just for the Irish, but as we look for who's the second best team in the ACC, a lot of people think it could be Virginia. That's a big game, I think, for Virginia to go on the road, see if they can compete with Notre Dame. And Notre Dame's going to have to show some kind of some moxie and some maturity to handle after being up so high last week to come back down and be at home. They better be ready to play against a hard-nosed team of Virginia.
Yeah, and Virginia coming off a game where they were down 17-0 to ODU, and you're like, what is going on with the ACC outside of Clemson, right?
Right.
And then they come back and they win that game, and they survive a game like that against Old Dominion. So looking forward to that. I've been looking forward to this one segment this entire week here. We've been asking you guys, if you like what you're hearing, to leave us a 5-star review, and you may get the chance to ask Herbie a question. Put that in the comment section of the best questions we'll make air. We picked out 3 questions from this past week, Herbie, and we're going to start with TLou90, who's got a question for you. Herbie, who is a team that no one is really talking about that you might think might be a dark horse for the college football playoff?
For the playoff?
Yeah.
That nobody's talking about. That's a little tricky. You know, we've talked about Clemson, Bama, Georgia, Ohio State, LSU, Oklahoma, just kind of separating themselves. Auburn, I feel like, is trending up into that group after what they did on the road. But outside of that, I think people have kind of forgotten there are maybe 2 teams. I would say Wisconsin would be a team. Now they've got to go to Columbus and play Ohio State. An area, by the way, a stadium, by the way, that they've have a history of playing pretty well. The Buckeyes look out. I mean, you could argue that Ohio State is executing at a level that's as good as anybody in the country. So, but Wisconsin, right now, the front runner in the Big Ten West. If they lose and they compete, maybe they get a rematch in a Big Ten championship. So maybe they get a second opportunity, against Ohio State. So Wisconsin would maybe be a team I would think about. And I still think Texas, even with 1 loss, a team that oftentimes gets forgotten, in the Big 12, all the focus on Jalen Hurts and Oklahoma. So those would be 2 that kind of off the top of my head, jump to mind.
And you have to think that if Texas wants to be considered, they've got to run the rest of the way and beat Oklahoma potentially twice, right?
That is, of absolutely. Course.
That showdown in the Cotton Bowl and then in the Big 12 championship game. We'll see how that plays out. All right, we got another question here from our listeners from Rev Millie OKC. What differences or improvements do you see in Jalen Hurts from his days at Alabama to what he's shown so far in 3 games for Oklahoma?
The first thing is that, first of all, I feel like people look at him as if he wasn't a good player. You know, I go back and watch his career at Alabama. He ended up losing out to potentially, you know, we look back 20, 30 years at Tua. We're going to look at one of the more prolific quarterbacks, probably in the last 30 years. So you got to keep that in mind that it wasn't as if he was just a terrible passer. He led them to the national championship and scored a potential game winning touchdown with a couple minutes to go until Deshaun Watson came back and led the Tigers right back and ended up hitting Hunter Renfrow in the last play of the game for a touchdown. So he is, and then the next year he takes them all the way back to the championship and then gets benched in the second half for Tua, and the rest is history. So he led his team to back-to-back years of getting into the national championship. It's pretty good to begin with. But what I see is a guy that has complete command of Lincoln Riley's system, which is a scary thought, no matter who the quarterback is, let alone any quarterback that has the skill set of Jalen Hurts, completing 80% of his passes, 9 touchdowns, doesn't have an interception. That speaks volumes that he's comfortable in what he's being asked to do. And so the accuracy, the decision making, his willingness to come off of his primary is the area I want to see his growth. Come off that primary that's covered. And in Alabama, he had a tendency to come off the primary and run. And a lot of times run effectively. But if he wants to take that next step as a passer and go to the NFL, he's got to come off the primary, find that second, third option. And I think we're seeing that. And then you throw in his legs within that Lincoln Riley system. And he is right now, he's as dangerous as anybody playing a position. And it's going to be a lot of fun as the competition gets a lot stiffer and tougher for OU. Be fun to see how he continues to grow and develop. But it's been a lot of fun so far.
And we're going to see a lot of offense this coming weekend. They're coming off a bye. They face off against Texas Tech. Then they got Kansas. And then the showdown against Texas October 12th. That weekend is going to be absolutely bananas when you look at all the matchups that we have heading into that weekend. All right, our final question here, and it's kind of tied into something I said earlier today on the podcast. Kirk, we've seen Melvin Gordon and Monty Ball as finalists for the Heisman. How does Jonathan Taylor compare, and do you like his chances of being a finalist or winning the Heisman?
Wisconsin, again, always has backs. I would put Melvin – I loved Monty Ball, but I think Melvin Gordon is kind of at a place by himself until – Jonathan Taylor has come around. And I think Gordon and Taylor, of all the Wisconsin backs, and Bobby, go all the way back to maybe Ron Dane, yeah, they all do things a little bit differently. What I see with Jonathan Taylor is a guy, first of all, that had immediate success. And when you get to know him as a person, he still feels like he needs to prove himself. And so I give his parents, I give his high school coaches, all the mentors that affected him and had been around him throughout his life when he was younger, I give them a lot of credit, because I was with him at the Doak Walker ceremony last February, and I happened to sit right next to him at dinner, and I knew him as a player, but after 2.5-3 hour dinner, I got a chance to get to know him as a person, and I walked away I was more impressed with him as a person than I was as a great number 23 running back. Mm-hmm. And that's the best part of our jobs, is getting a chance to get to know these guys. And so I would tell you, he works just as hard today at practice and in the weight room as he did when he was a senior in high school or a freshman trying to prove himself. That the reason I bring that up is it tells you a little bit about why he continues to get better. And that's a rare thing to see, a guy that had as big a year as he did as a freshman continue to work. And so what's in his game? Obviously the explosiveness, the speed. I think he's grown with his patience, with his vision, like most backs do, the more reps they get. But I just think he just continues to become a more polished and better all-around player, catching the ball now out of the backfield, blocking when teams are blitzing. He's just a total package. So I don't want to sit here and say, yeah, he's better than Melvin Gordon. Melvin Gordon's better than him. I think he's unique in his own way. But the thing that really separates him to me is the early success that he had and how he just – unwilling to accept all the accolades, just put his head down and just continues to work. And he's leading this team. And this team right now, they have big goals and an inexperienced quarterback. So his leadership, I think, is a big part of what they're trying to do. And if he doesn't make it to New York City, then they shouldn't have a Heisman Trophy ceremony.
I agree. I
mean, he needs to be in New York City if they're going to have a Heisman ceremony this year. Now, keep in mind, ESPN, the Heisman Trust, they don't decide who goes. The 900-plus voters, mm-hmm, and how they vote dictates who goes to New York City. But if you have a vote for a Heisman, you get 3 spots. 1, two, and three. And if you vote for whoever at one, he gets 3 points. Whoever at two, he gets 2 points. And whoever's at third on your list gets 1 point. So they add up all the points. I just encourage anybody who's voting on the Heisman, I do, and I hope others that are listening, if they're voting, please look at Jonathan Taylor and everything he's doing, not just with his stats, but what he brings to the table as far as the intangibles.
And I'm not exaggerating here. In an era where we talk about passing nonstop, we have maybe the most underrated 2,000-yard running back in the history of college football. He's mentioned in the same breath as Herschel Walker, and Herschel was a god in the 80s, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the reason it's two things. He plays for Wisconsin. And they are, for whatever reason, for most people, a little bit off the radar. And number two, it's his personality. You know, he's not flamboyant. He's not demanding certain things. He's not talking trash. Think of AB and think of the complete opposite end of the spectrum. Think of Jalen Ramsey. Think of the opposite end of the spectrum. That's who he is. He's humble to a fault, hardest worker on the roster. So we don't like the people. When I say we, the social media world of today, they don't like guys like Jonathan Taylor. It's like, he's a good guy. Okay, let's move on to the next guy. Oh, there's Jalen Ramsey. What's he doing today? Oh, he's sick all week. All right, that's a good. We don't like the. Oh, he's in the weight room again. It's class. He's doing what he's supposed to do. Ah, that's no fun. I think that's okay. I think that's actually a good thing. But you know, today it's just kind of You know, all right, I guess.
As a guy that does SportsCenter as my normal job, I was hoping to survive the whole podcast without talking about Antonio Brown.
or Ramsey.
Jalen Ramsey talk's going to be happening on SportsCenter this whole week. But none of that here. Herbie, this was great. Looking forward to Lincoln and that environment for College Game Day. Cannot wait. We'll see you on SportsCenter coming up Tuesday, 6 p.m.
Awesome, bud. Have a great week.
Really love the three questions we had today for Herbie. We appreciate you guys listening. And if you like what you're hearing, leave us a 5-star review. You may get the chance to ask Herbie your question. Put that in the comments section, Apple Podcasts, and the best questions will make the air. Also want to thank Herbie for joining us to get his thoughts on the weekend. And we want to thank our sponsors, Allstate, Carhartt, and Goodyear. Big thanks to our producer for putting up with me for the last couple of weeks with that awful voice of mine. I feel like I'm coming back out of that daze with the cold as well as the allergies. Gabe Bassain, who's always on the other side, making us sound very good. Ahead on Wednesday, Pollock's going to join us along with Ivan Maisel to break down the best of the week and the players you should be talking about to impress your friends. Until then, thanks for listening.